Welcome to PA Nation, the entertainment podcast about life below the line. I'm your host, Cooper Peltz. On this episode, we talk to comedian John Gabris. He started his career at a local New York news station where his dad was an IOTC stagehand. We discuss how he balanced working as a PA while performing at UCB in New York, what it takes to build a career that can withstand a global pandemic, and the best strategies for getting away with telling someone to put away their phone in a movie theater without them wanting to fight you. If you enjoy our show, please rate and review it on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening. Those two actions make all the difference for us being able to make more and more episodes for you. If you'd like to get in contact with us, feel free to email us at panationpodcast@gmail.com or hit us up on Twitter or Instagram at panationpodcast. All right, thanks for giving this a listen. Here we go. You've seen him on shows like Guy Code, Wild and Out, Younger. You've heard him featured on podcasts like Comedy Bang Bang, Doughboys, Improv for Humans. And he's created his own shows too, Action Boys, High and Mighty, and The Gino Lombardo Show, which just began its second season on Stitcher Premium. This is John Gabris.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for being on the show. This is a big get. This is a big deal for our show.
I was literally going to say the same thing.
No, honestly, it's like, it's
it's huge.
For me? It is huge. It's huge. Yeah, exactly. I in like researching you, just like seeing the like amount of stuff you're doing, the amount of stuff you've been doing like since the pandemic hit is just like, it's pretty amazing. I feel like you haven't like skipped a beat with this whole like working from home stuff.
I'm trying not to. Yeah. I'm very inspired by my wife, who has an actual job and is working full time out of the living room, that I can't just sit back here and fuck around. back here being the High and Mighty studio / extra bedroom that I record my podcast and apparently also your podcast out of.
Exactly. has that been like a big change? Was she like working out of an office and mostly work from home, right?
Yeah, I mostly work from home. She mostly works out of office. For me, the big change. Yeah. So now we're home full time all the time together. Mm-hmm. We both used to travel for work. So that's like all crazy and piled up. But the exciting thing is, I mean, like the real hard thing for me is I miss in-person conversation, which was like why I launched my podcast. I never did a remote episode until like mid-March, you know. That was my first time ever doing that, and I was like, oh, this is like not as fun, but I see how it's cool to get people that wouldn't normally want to come to my house or don't live in the Southern California area. But it's been like I've become, and we were kind of talking about this before we started to record, but like, for example, like my only real training in life is in comedy, and every fucking 6 months to a year, I have to completely learn an entire new like skill set just to make a few bucks to stay alive. Like, like originally when I learned podcasting, that was one thing. Then I learned like how to upload and do all this shit by myself, and now I've learned how to remote record, Zoom, microphones, QuickTime, like all this shit I never previously had to know.
Yeah.
Now. And that's like, I always talk about this and joke about it with friends. It's like being an actor, quote unquote, being an actor until you're just like on 12 seasons of something and they just, you know, someone does everything for you.
Yeah.
Until then, you do so much shit that isn't acting.
So many skills that you like I was an actor like in high school and stuff like that. And the first job I ever had was like for these like. Was for like the Disney upfronts, like for like internal stuff. And it was like all of a sudden I had to know how to like spin a basketball on my finger. And I've never played basketball. I've never done anything. And they're just like, they assume that I know how to spin a basketball on my finger. So I had to go outside for like 20 minutes and like learn how to do this.
There's that. And then there's also like, so how do you normally wear your hair? And you're like, I don't. And then it's like, hey, so what kind of clothes? Can you bring a suit to the audition? Like, you know, and I'm like, I don't own a suit. I'm an actor. And then it's like, oh, I don't know how to, like, I've had a wardrobe person be like, you don't know how to tie a tie? I'm like, no, I went to public school.
Yeah.
And then it's like, and now add to that, like doing taxes or self-tape or uploading or reaching out to people, going to coffee meetings, going to pitch meetings, like all the shit that isn't acting or isn't comedy is like now all a huge part of your life. And so for now, I'm like, all of a sudden I've become a 38-year-old like Luddite. I've now become a dude who sits in front of a screen. I have two monitors. I have fucking connect, like I have mics and cables and shit all over. I'm like, thinking of getting into like live streaming from my house. I'm like, okay, well, what to quit now? I'm all of a sudden like this fucking like hacker or some shit.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's like the man in like Mission Impossible or something like that, like in his ear.
Yeah. Oh yeah. I'm sitting with like a headset, a microphone, in front of two monitors, all kinds of cables, and like I've got my Wi-Fi upgraded, Wi-Fi extenders set up throughout that. Like over the course of like the last 6 months, I've just been settling into like I'm eventually going to be able to run like a fucking Pornhub out of my house, like a server out of my house.
You're like a black hat or something.
Yeah, exactly. Everyone's favorite Michael Mann movie.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. So were you always like that kind of like quick study or something like?
No.
Growing up, were you able to like kind of just like turn things on and be like, okay, I think I can figure this out?
Not really. The main skill set I've had that I think have saved my career and my life in the last I'm okay at a bunch of stuff, and I'm not afraid to learn new stuff, because this is like this is shit I don't want to learn at all. But now that I've learned it, like the last couple of months of recording podcasts in my house has been slightly easier. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, oh, so that's what you have to do.
Yeah. Yeah. Finding the context of stuff I found is so important to me. Like I took some test in like high school and was like, what kind of like future is like good for you? And like my highest score was like, I need to know like the context of everything. And it like makes me feel so much more secure. And I feel like that's what you're describing, is just like, okay, now I know like quick time. Like, I don't know, like you were so fast on, we're recording this on Zencastr, like switching the microphone from like your headset to your microphone or whatever it was. And just like, it's amazing. Like the different, like just knowing the full, like holistic context of something makes like the creative process much easier, I feel like.
Yes, yes. And like, that's the other thing I need to keep reminding myself, is that I get so lost in like the, make sure you record ads, make sure you do this, book a guest, like all the stuff that I don't want to be doing, like scheduling, that's a nightmare for me. Like, I don't want to be like, but it's like, okay, I have PA Nation 11 a.m. Wednesday. Okay, let me check the lot. Like, I have to run my own calendar. All these skills that, like, I guess they are skills that everyone eventually learns. Like, I'm sure anyone who's listening to this podcast who has like a real job is like, the fuck are you complaining about? Like, how do you type? How do you do email? What the fuck is up with this dude? But like, that's, it's kind of how I feel, is that like, doing calendar. And then by the time you sit down and you're just sitting across from your stranger on Zoom to record your podcast, you're like, ah, the thing that I got into this to do, like, oh, and then that's only 60 to 90 minutes of like your 4 hours a week of weekly podcast shit to do.
Yeah. Yeah. It's so true. Like, I love that you brought up time. I'm teaching myself how to type faster. Like, it's so, like, I type with like two fingers, and I found this website that's like teaching me how to type with like all of my fingers. And it's crazy the difference, like, in speed. Like, I'm super slow now, but I've been watching like these YouTubers being like, this is how you type fast, and this is how it helps me. It's so amazing, like, cutting down the time from like having a thought in your head to getting it on like a document is so, like, I didn't realize how important that was, because like, you lose stuff every second that you're not putting it down.
Yeah, I'm curious, by the way, like, can I ask how old you are? Because like, I'm a fucking master. I'm a quick typer, and I think it's from like being the instant messenger generation.
Yeah, I was like, that was my sister's generation. So I'm 26.
Yeah,
so
that makes sense. I'm 38. So I like, I was like in college courting my wife over AOL instant messenger. So that's just like nonsense. You're the generation that learned to type on a phone.
Exactly. Yeah, my generation thumbs can go real fast.
Yeah. And if I sent you a text right now, you'd be like, I think Gabrus is having a stroke. Like, my thumbs are too fat, too slow, but I'm not bad at a keyboard. Like, I've got AOL, I've got, whatchamacallit, Apple Messages set up on my desktop. Mm-hmm. And now my wife works out of the living room. So we type to each other like, hey, I'm going to make lunch. Do you want something? I'm going to take the dog out in 20 minutes. Do you want to go for a walk? Like, and we're flashing back to the year is 2001 and we're flirting over Instant Messenger. 19 years later, technology has come and gone thousands of ways. And now we don't text over phone because we're both home and we're both at computers. So now I type over it like, and you can type, you know, text people's phones from from the Messenger app. So I'm fucking like texting my friends, but I'm writing like on a keyboard. So I'm like, so here's what I was thinking. We can maybe head over tomorrow to the blah, blah. And it's like, I just
like
send a
paragraphs
paragraph.
And paragraphs.
And then they just hit me with like the thumbs up reaction. Like, sounds good. And I'm like, oh yeah, what am I doing here?
Have you been watching Pen 15?
I watched the first season. I've watched the first episode of the second season. I haven't.
We're in the exact same spot. Watched the first episode of second season, and that whole storyline of the AIM stuff is so funny to me because it is like the way that I experience that is how I'm experiencing it on the show as well. Is like I was over my sister's shoulder, like watching her type, you know? It's like such a weird flashback, being like, oh, I'm doing this like through a monitor now, like on a TV show. It's so weird, the thing, like, you know, like in the 60s when they were making like a bunch of like World War II movies, and it was like, oh, that's like a period piece now because it's like, you know, what it's like 20 years later. It's like now Pen 15 is like the period piece. It's such like a bizarre like head trip for me.
Yeah, that is pretty weird. Yeah, and like the people on Pen 15 are younger than me. So like the shit that the culture that they're living through is like my high school culture, which is like, you know, like I was a little older than them. So it's so fun to watch it from that perspective of like, I got Instant Messenger on my computer. Like I got AOL on my computer when I was like 16 or 17, when like I was actively seeking pornography. Like, you know, like the first thing I did was A/S/L, age, sex, location. You know, like, who are the 20-year-old females in New York? Let's hang out, baby.
So
like, I would know what to do if I hung out with a fucking woman over online anyway.
I feel like my generation, all of that was over text, which you're totally right about. Like my first phone was like the chocolate. Do you remember that phone?
Yes.
It was like this beautiful, like red, just my favorite thing in the world. And I would get texts and I wasn't allowed to text back. Like my parents were like super strict with that.
Was
and
the
I
chocolate feel like, the one that like slid open like a cigarette pack or whatever?
Exactly.
Yeah.
It felt super slick.
It is. It was slick at the time. I remember that now.
Yeah. So that was like, but my parents were like super strict. And so I couldn't text any of my friends back. And I feel like that's how I am still today. Like when I get texts, I'm so bad like responding because I feel like my parents like pounded into me that idea of like, you're not allowed to text people back for some reason. I don't know. There's something wrong with me.
Yeah, I agree. I had one of those Nokia T9, like blue. I had like a sky blue brick as my first phone. But
with
I had
like Snake or whatever.
Oh yeah, with like the little glow in the dark screen. I had that shit kind of early too. Like I would have been 15 or 16. It would have been like 97 or 98, like junior or senior.
Wow.
I got my first phone, which I was.
So you guys were rolling. You guys were a fancy family.
Yeah, we had. Not so much a fancy family. I'll give you the backstory as to why I had a phone, because I also had a beeper in like ninth grade. So I had a beeper mad early, and I was not selling drugs. The only people beeping me were my girlfriend and my mom. And the reason my mom wanted us to have beepers, wanted us to have cell phones, is because my parents were wildly like out of pocket working parents. You know what I mean? They were like barely ever home. So they thought like giving us phones and ways to call them and tell us where we are and all that shit would be the thing that would save us.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, no, it. And like, but that's, we weren't that wealthy, but we were like, you know, we were middle class, but this was like the big thing we got. And it was, in hindsight, just like a digital leash, more or less.
Yeah. It was like out of necessity.
Yeah.
So am I right? Your dad like worked at a news station or something like that?
Yeah. My dad worked at at Fox 5 News, not Fox News, but at Fox 5, the Fox 5 10 o'clock news, the local news in New York.
The affiliate.
Yeah. The affiliate. He was stagehand electrician, IOTSI, Local One. Shout out to all our unions. And that was, he did that. My grandfather, his father-in-law, my mom's dad, was a union elevator operator in that building, which is like one of the most like, you know, mafia adjacent jobs you can
have. Yeah, that's like,
I was like, like my grandpa and all his brothers, who are all last named Valentino, all had like assorted New York City union jobs, whether it was like Broadway, like everyone in that family, my whole mother and my whole mom's side, like her dad and all the first generation Italian guys and gals all worked on Broadway or in New York City in like assorted theatrical unions. And then when my dad, a high school dropout, wanted to marry my mom, my grandfather said, if you want to marry my daughter, you have to cut your hair. My dad had like waist length hair. Cut your hair, get a GED, I'll get you a union job, and then you're allowed to marry my daughter.
So he did it.
Yeah, my dad did all that. like, obviously, like, my father-in-law, my grandpa, his father-in-law, like, saved my dad's life. Like, gave him something to do and gave him money that would allow him to put food on the table for three kids and put my mom through college and nursing school and all that shit.
Yeah.
So it all worked out.
Those.
But so I've always been, like, a union guy, a TV guy. And then when I was going away to college and I was like, a biology major, but I was interested in working in television. My dad's like, if you're seriously thinking about television, don't go to college. Come work in the city, and in 1 year you could be making $90,000 as like a PA, as a like a stagehand, as in IOTSI. And I was like, no, that's not exactly for me. So instead, I spent like spent $100,000 of my parents' money and $100,000 of my own student loan money to go to a private college to major in radio, TV, film, and then to graduate and get a job as a PA at Viacom that paid $340 a week after taxes. I was working 70-hour weeks and taking home about I think it was like 344 or 286 were like the two big paychecks I've gotten.
Yeah.
And I just was like, remembering my dad being like, and you could be making 90 grand in 1 year. And I'm like, what am I doing?
What did I do? Yeah. But here's the thing that is really like standing out to me in that story is the difference between a blue collar, you know, like entertainment job, like in a union, kind of like doing the more physical work and the more technical work and stuff like that versus someone like yourself, who I see as a much more, I don't know, creative person.
Yeah, I mean, that was the main thing, because I didn't even know what I wanted to do. Like, I was like, oh, I'll major in radio, TV, film. Then maybe I'll be like a director or something. Like, I wasn't even positive. Like, what I knew I wanted to work in movies or TV. Like, that was the only thing I had, figured out. Mm-hmm. And so that for me was like, that's all I needed, was like, I've got it. That's me. Let's do it.
Yeah. So did you ever like go to work with your dad or anything like that? Or was it just like this kind of vague idea of like, okay, I know what like my family does. I know like, okay, these guys are on Broadway. These guys, you know, this is a news station. Yeah. I know this like vaguely.
I actually did go to do a lot of shifts with my dad. Especially once I got home in the summers over college and over winter break, he'd be like, I'm supposed to bring in another guy. And, you know, this is where we just bring in friends of friends for like a day gig or whatever. And my dad would always be like, well, what about my son? And someone would be like, yeah, bring him in. He likes movies and shit. So I would go in there and help my dad in like, you know, peak cush union gig where he's like, all right, on the commercial, run out and hand this water out. You know, like, come with me. We got to switch a light bulb, but I need you to hold the ladder. Like all just like the most basic ass shit. But it felt so cool. And then when I got my first paycheck, there were like all these things on the side, and I was like, whoa, why did I get this one extra thing? And my dad was like, oh, because they had to do sports extra, so they kept us an extra half hour. And I'm like, he's like, well, that's time and a half. And also, that's technically a second show, so you get 2 hours for that, whatever. And like all these like union things he was explaining to me. And I just, my eyes lit up, and I'm like, so the harder you work or the more shit you do, the more money you make, like, which is not a thing. It's not a thing in a lot of jobs. There's not like a direct relation. And I was like, oh, so this is why my dad was always picking up weird shifts and be like, oh, you know, dad's getting a hotel room in the city tonight because he's only got 2 hours off in between shifts or whatever. I'll be like, that's fucking crazy. And then you're like, oh, he's like, that's how my dad, who has like a base salary of $80,000 a year, can like pay for a family of five to do things. It's because you fucking, you got to do the 16-hour day, the crazy overtime and all that shit to get it going, which I'm very thankful for. But that really turned me on. And the other thing I should say about this was a lot of the dudes who work in Union New York Television, like that at the time, I'm 21 going in there, you know, between 16 and 21. These guys are between 40 and 50, and they're all New York fucking, like, but at the same time, I'm from Long Island, which is like just outside of New York City. And it's, we've got a little bit of like an anti-intellectual bent to our like lifestyle over there. Uh-huh. And one of my dad's coworkers was this tall, super interesting guy. He had Sally Jesse Raphael glasses and he wore like dress shirts with suspenders. Uh-huh. And my dad was like a jeans and like Giants t-shirt guy. This dude, Chris, was so cool. And he was very like, he was a New York City guy. And I didn't know what that meant at the time in like 99 through 2004. But he had like, he ate sushi for dinner, which my dad made fun of him for. He like, he had been to Asia. Now I'm getting, I mean, everything is just Asian, but his wife was Asian. He had like traveled abroad a bunch. He was very much a movie buff and like would always be like to me, like, and treat and talk to me like an adult once I was working there, because my only, my coworker at the time was my dad. So it's like this weird dynamic. But when another 50-year-old man's like, oh, you like Goodfellas? You should watch Mean Streets. You would really like that. I'm like, oh, what's Mean Streets? And they're like, oh, it's one of Marty Scorsese's movies. I'm like, who's Martin Scorsese? He's like, oh, the director of Goodfellas, the movie you like. I'm like, oh, cool. And they're like, what other movies is it? And all of a sudden I'm talking to like a grown city, like film nerd about like movies. And I'm like, oh my God. And that's like locked in that I knew I wanted to work in a business where other people loved movies and TV as much as I did. So it was like, that was the clincher for me. I like, you know, switch my major from biology to radio, TV, film, partially out of laziness, out of like, oh, I'd rather take intro to film than any science classes.
So but, did you feel like you needed to like catch up a little bit? Because I feel like just judging from your podcast Raised by TV, like so many things, you were like very like pop culture heavy, but were there areas where you were like, oh, I don't know anything?
I was very much a TV and video games were my babysitters type kid. So like I was and then like my one thing my dad did like was movies and action movies. So we watched the, like one thing we did have in common was that. So we'd do that together a lot. When you're like a fucking older brother of three kids, like I have two younger brothers and I was like, the latchkey kid that would open the like open the door after school when I was like 12, and the three of us would just be home. My youngest brother would be like 5 at the time, and I'd be like, I'm just home babysitting these kids till through dinner or whatever. So like movies and like if we could find a movie to put on and like kill 2 hours just staring at the TV, like that was 2 hours we weren't like outside jumping off the shed and shit like that. So but then I became sort of like and this is, I think, one of my other skill sets besides being like a jack of all trades. Actually, these two skill sets probably dovetail nicer together. Another facet of my personality is I'm very curious. So when I get into movies, I'm like, well, now there's a lot of stuff I don't know about. And that bothers me when I don't know stuff about something I like. Or like if I watch a movie or something or read a book or watch a show and I don't fully understand what happened, that like undoes my brain in a way. I'm so, so comfortable, so familiar with just understanding what's going on that when I don't, I'm like, what the fuck? And that just like activates me. So the second someone's like, oh, Mean Streets, you never heard of Martin Scorsese? I'm like, got it. And then my senior year of high school, every Friday night I was lifeguard. I was a lifeguard in the summers at the beach, but every Friday night I also lifeguarded at Hofstra University. And my shift ended at 10. I drove to Blockbuster, rented two movies, and stayed up till 3 in the morning every night, or you know, 2:30 in the morning every Friday night, senior year of high school, by myself, and watched two movies back to back.
One like so much.
One silly one and one like intense one. Like always, like I was like, oh, we're gonna watch Taxi Driver and you know, I can't even think of a Lawnmower Man. Like I'm just gonna get these two, and I just started like checking off, and then like use that as like, oh, cool. Like, well, I liked, I didn't like Blade Runner, but like, oh, what about this? Or I watched Clockwork Orange and I'd say to my dad, that was really intense. What other movies are like, do you know that are super intense? He'd be like, have you ever seen Last House on the Left? And I'd be like, no. And then I watch it. And I'm like, well, dad, that's not intense in the same way I want. Yeah. Like, that's a complete, a woman bites a man's dick off. And he goes, I know, it's crazy, right? So it's just like one of those things where I like, found myself, and then like my first summer after high school, I got that lifeguarding job and I was making money. I had two different jobs. I was making so much money and I got a DVD player before I went away to college. So this is 99, nice. 2000, maybe the first DVD player, like truly. And I just fucking like spent every loose dollar I had on DVDs. Like, oh, I'd be like, I would go to Blockbuster and be like, I kind of want to see this movie. But it's $3 to rent, and if I'm late returning it, it's going to cost me $4, $5. In the bargain bin is a $9 copy of that movie. All right, let's just own it. Now I have a fucking, like, two trunks that are buried in my storage unit full of DVDs and Blu-rays that now when I watch a movie for one of my podcasts, it's like, oh, I got to watch Pumping Iron. I have to track it down on streaming rather than open up my bins and, like, get out the DVDs. It's like I'm renting movies on iTunes that I have in my garage. I just don't have the time to look for them.
Like I feel like the last generation to have that experience of Blockbuster where you go and you just walk around the store for like 4 hours looking at all the movies. Like I would just look at all of the covers and be like, and my parents were pretty strict. By the time I grew up, it was like, oh, I remember that cover. I'm going to watch it now. You know, it's like such a fun kind of full circle moment. I feel like the kind of idea of like curating your own collection is kind of lost on this like streaming kind of thing that we're on that I really miss, because it doesn't feel as special that you can watch a Clockwork Orange or something like that, you know, where you're like, oh, I found it. Or like for me, like in college, I didn't have like streaming stuff. And so I would go to like each library and be like, oh, I found this like Francois Truffaut movie, like at some like tiny little library, like in the middle of nowhere. Like, oh, that's awesome. And then like you go home and watch it and you're like, oh, I remember everything about it because I remember the story of like finding it, you know?
Well, I know exactly what you're talking about, like being in college and someone being like, oh, Gabrus, you have Anchorman on DVD? I'm like, fuck yeah. And they're like, oh, please, can I borrow it? I'm like, yes, I'm a king because I have this. You know what I mean? Like, that shit feels good. And you're right. Like, the Blockbuster shopping is something that I try to do again by just endlessly surfing streaming services. Uh-huh. But Blockbuster shopping, your parents were strict about what you could watch. My parents had no rules about that. But we did have the one movie. We're only allowed to rent one movie because we were like, we had money rules in my house, and we're three boys, three brothers. And so like, that's what took so long at Blockbuster. It was like, okay, we got Dr. Giggles. You know, we'd have like four, we narrow it down to like the four movie. And we're like, all right, let's make sure we definitely get this next week. Like, you know, like just brothers just trying to sort out exactly what we're allowed to watch. What can like, oh, we got to get this one. We've never seen this one, you know? So we're that fucking crate. That was our big to do as kids, was trying to figure that shit out.
Yeah, totally. Something very interesting that I found, like in researching you, Lenny Bruce went to your high school?
Yeah, and this is crazy that you say this, because I found this out on someone else's podcast. I just searched my high school on someone else's, like while I was a guest on someone else's podcast, like on Wikipedia. Uh-huh. I just searched, and then they were like, Lenny Bruce went to my high school briefly or whatever. Or Lenny Bruce was from Long Island. I didn't even know that. And then to find out he went to my high school, I'm like, well, that's actually a very cool like sort of origin story that I'm now getting, figuring out 15 years into my comedy career, which is kind of like a fun way to get hit by it, too, is like I hadn't thought about it in a long time. And then all of a sudden I hear this and you're like, oh, shit.
So were you, as far as like comedy go, like you were watching, you know, comedies and stuff like that, but like when did it become apparent to you like, oh, this is something that maybe I'm like interested in long term?
The crazy thing was is that I never, like, it wasn't until I got to college and started doing comedy with a comedy group that I thought about I was always into comedy and I made videos with my friends and like all this stupid shit, but I never thought about like, oh, this is a and like, no need to get into this now. I'll save it for, I have a therapy later, but like my parents were never like, oh, you really like comedy, or you're like truly every adult that comes over says you're very funny for like a 15-year-old boy, or like very smart and very. Never once in my parents go like, well, do you like comedy? Do you want to go see a comedy show? Do you like, oh, Jonathan, do you know you could be a comedian if you wanted? Like, that shit never came up. Like, and so I just never even thought about that. But I can tell you, like, sort of like in with hindsight, my origin story was that like 9th or 10th grade, A&E, the channel A&E, if you remember TV, and specifically weird cable channels, A&E would air Bud Friedman's Evening at the Improv, which was just like a random half hour of like, it was like, you know, 4 or 5 6-minute sets of like from the 70s and 80s of stand up comics. Just like some good, some bad, some recognizable, some not recognizable. But they aired from aired at 6 a.m. and 6:30 a.m. on weekdays for like whatever year this was, you know, 95, 96, 97, whatever year it was. And I would wake up at 6 a.m. I had to leave for school at like 7:15. I would wake up at 6 a.m. and get ready and eat breakfast and all that shit on commercials, and then watch stand up every morning before school from 6 to 7 a.m.
That's awesome.
So if I think doing that for 1 year just sets you up to want to do comedy. Like, there's no other way. Like, and I never even thought about it. I just was like, oh, I like this, and there's variety, and I like everyone's opinions. And then you start to get favorite people, and you're like, oh, this guy is Richard Belzer. He's funny. I like his bit about blank. Like, and I started to like see this whole world that I didn't know existed. I mean, I knew about stand-up comedy. I loved, you know, Dana Carvey, Jerry Seinfeld, all this shit that I loved, but I didn't know about. I saw what looked like hundreds of other people that weren't mega famous, but happened to be stand-up comedians. And now I'm like, oh shit, this is like so fucking like, this is, and then now, you know, eventually in the year 2000, someone would say like, hey, you're pretty funny, you should audition for this comedy group. And then I would become like full blown, like all I care about is comedy starting in the year 2000 until question mark. I mean, I care about it less and less every year. So to be fair, I'm on my way out. I mean,
you're a hacker now. So yeah, it's true. Comedy can be your fallback.
Yeah, I don't need comedy now. I'm fucking zero cool, brother. But with hindsight, I was like, oh, that's probably when I got really into comedy. And like, I always had the ability to remember. And I think this is like, I don't mean to be like gender biased here, but I think boys, and especially my generation of boys, learn to communicate with other boys via like saying Simpsons lines and movie lines and comedy lines, and like that was like how men connect, boys connected in my childhood. So like me being the guy who knew every stand-up routine by heart and every comedy movie by heart, people would always be like, you know, I'd be able to do any scenes from movies, make my friends crack up, and I'm like, oh, I wonder if I did my own shit, I could make, you know what I mean? Like, then you start to figure that world out, and all of a sudden now you're having a fucking, now all your friends think you're hysterical. And then I learned like the real like artistic kickoff of, and this is still not even artistic, but was making hot girls and teachers laugh in school. That reaction, once you can make your friends laugh, you're like, ha, that's pretty cool. But then when a hot girl laughs at you, when you're getting no attention from chicks whatsoever because you're like, have breasts and wear like fucking a yin yang puff paint crew neck sweatshirt to school, but then you like get the hot girl in your class to laugh, and you're like, wait a minute, that's a weird power dynamic thing. Like,
yeah,
she doesn't laugh at the cool kid, she laughs at me because I'm funny. Holy shit. And then like seeing, getting a teacher to laugh, getting a teacher to be like, she doesn't want to laugh at me because what I'm doing is wrong, but if I get her to laugh at me, motherfucker, I win. You know what I mean? So that's how I felt. That's like, that's what kicked me off in college, is like, I mean, yeah, in high school, was like seeing that and then learning like, this is worth it. Like, making these people laugh makes, you know, is worth it for me.
Yeah. So when you start like... training feels like a strange word to use while talking about comedy, but when you're like, you start socializing with like other people that are aspiring to be the funniest person in the room, is that, does it kind of feel like, I would imagine it's something like you're the best quarterback at your high school or whatever, and then you go to college and you're like, you know, surrounded by everyone was the best quarterback in their high school or what, you know, whatever it is.
Yeah, yeah.
Was it that feeling or did you feel like, no, I feel pretty confident about this stuff.
In high school, I was like the class clown, but I wasn't that confident. Everyone thought I was funny, but I wasn't like that popular. Everyone liked me, but I didn't have a lot of friends, like that kind of world. But when I went away to college, I think it's safe to say I was potentially like, and this is not a brag. I've got 20 years of hindsight. I don't fucking care. but I think I may have been like the funniest, most popular kid in like my grade, like freshman year of college. I went to a small enough school that it was only had like 6,000 total students. Like, so I wasn't like, and I was like the dude with frosted tips and wore pajama pants and like no shirt or a fucking like sweater with a big daisy on it. Like I was that guy. Like I thought I was Van Wilder, but, and I was also like on the comedy group that did like monthly big shows and shit like that. So, and I was like constantly doing huge, weird, like dangerous shenanigans, like as most like attention starved college freshmen are prone to do. So I was just kind of like, I developed the confidence there. And then the real big fish moving into a way bigger pond was leaving after college, was moving to New York City and starting doing UCB classes and trying to be like, okay, well, I was the funniest kid at this small school for 4 years. Let's fucking keep it up. And then luckily enough, I had the ego and confidence to like take me into a real brutal learning curve of like,
yeah,
that was when I got the whole, oh, everyone is good at comedy. You know what I mean? Like, not everyone that's good at comedy decides to move to Poughkeepsie for college, but a lot of people who are good at comedy decide to move to New York City to do comedy.
Yeah. And one aspect of like all of that and seeing my friends kind of go through this as well, like in LA, being a PA and then being like, oh, I have a, you know, my 301 class show or whatever is like on Friday. I really hope we don't have to work late because then I'll have to like drive over, you know, all of that kind of stuff. As far as like that scheduling thing, that I feel like is so stressful. Was that an aspect of like your PAing and like your interning and stuff and balancing that with like, you know, hanging out with the improv people or, you know, all of that kind of stuff?
Holy shit, yes. I took my level one at UCB in between my junior and senior year of college, like while I was a lifeguard. I was that into improv that I like Googled, you know, I happened to stumble across their theater. So I went and took my level one in the summer. I think that's this puts it at the summer of 99. Mm-hmm. And so, Jesus Christ, 21 years of doing improv. 21 Very years of doing cool. improv. And look at me now. I'm on PA Nation living the fucking dream. But yeah, so I would go from like the beach, lifeguarding at Jones Beach, one day a week, beg to have the early shift, which all the older people want so they could be with their families and they don't mind waking up early. But I would beg for one day a week to have the early shift. Race to the train station, jump on the Long Island Railroad and head into the city to take a class. Could not go out for drinks or go see a show after because I always had to like wake up early to lifeguard the next day. Mm-hmm. And then I do the same thing the summer after I graduate, get a job as a PA, work weekends at Jones Beach, and then one night a week I'm taking a UCB class. And I just beg every time, because like Viacom in that time was like the permalance shit where you'd get like a 10-week gig.
Mm-hmm.
And it just meant like if you got a 10-week job or whatever as a PA at Viacom, it was like you're giving over your life for $600 a week before taxes and you $500 a week before taxes to start. And you have no like deal with it. I just got the number in my head. It was like 286.84 was like what my weekly paycheck was after like 60 hours a week for a while. But I would just be like, just for the next 8 Wednesdays, I have to leave at 6:30. If there's other shit to do at night, I will do it at 10 p.m. I want to take, and like a lot of people were understanding. Mm-hmm. Then when I went to become a PA at like Best Week Ever, they were a little less understanding because a lot of them were comedy people, like writers and producers, and they were just like, which is weird. You know, they're like, no, you're a fucking PA. Just shut up. And I'm like, I think I'm funnier than you, but I'll just deal with this. So then I, like, eventually, Viacom had this thing where if you worked for a year, they would, like, help you pay for adult education. People were taking, like, editing classes and stuff, and I made a case that improv would help me. So I got them to pay for my 301. I have a distinct memory of riding the train down. This is how far like signing up for classes has come. Like, I remember riding the train down to 23rd Street and handing $300 cash out of the ATM to Chad Carter and being like, I would like to take level three with, it wasn't even called 301 then. It was like level 3A. I'm like, I'd like to take level 3A with Michael Delaney, please. And like, just handing cash. And that was like over a week's pay just to take a fucking improv class.
I mean, prices haven't improved at all.
No, I think they're rising a little faster than inflation too.
I think so, yeah. So how did you first like score your first internship? Where that was at VH1?
Yeah, I was an intern at VH1 to start, and that was very much a nepotism type thing in that one of the dudes who started the college comedy group I was in, the Humorists at Marist College. So Hugh Marist. Okay. We know. But one of the dudes who started it got a job at VH1 after college and like kind of climbed the ranks. He was like this guy, Jeff Baumgartner. I got to shout him out because not only did he get me my first internship, but since then he's gotten me two different paying TV jobs. So
that's
he
awesome.
Has really been taking care of me for 16 years. So he was like the first dude to graduate and get an internship. And then what he would do is pretty much any humorist that wanted an internship, he would fight tooth and nail to get. And so like we funneled, and it was because like it was this distinctly like it was to intern at VH1 in the I love the, you know what I mean? Like, So I was working at VH1 at the peak of I love the 90s, I love the 70s, I love the 80s, the best week ever, the VH1 goes inside, A to Z, like all the clip show stuff that they just repackaged in 1,000 different ways.
Mm-hmm.
Like my first gig was I was an intern on I love the 90s part, duh. And then I got hired right after college to be a PA on Celeb Diet Secrets starring Moby and Mel B and one other. But it was like a one off thing that was just like a 10 week gig. So Baumgartner gets another humorist a job when they graduate, the next grade after him, it gets everyone an internship in their senior year. And that's pretty much an onboard. If you get an internship in your first or second semester senior year, it's pretty easy to dovetail that like in the I love the world they're doing enough shit with enough teams that they're like, well, we have these two interns from that spring semester, we need two PA positions filled on this huge thing, why don't we give them both a chance, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
so then like people were just getting staffed up that way for a while, and a dude the year before me did that, a dude the year before him did that, all white men, of course. And so then when it came my turn, my senior year, I got the internship through the guy who got it through Baumgartner. And then after my senior year, I got the job from the... And, like, I have some regrets. I didn't need a PA job right after college. Like, I could have lifeguarded for one more summer. A dude who I'm still very tight with, that I played rugby with in college, was like, I'm moving to California. I'll pay for your flight home if you want to drive cross country with me. And I couldn't because I was starting this PA job.
Yeah.
And I'm almost 40 and I've never driven across the country, but I've had 1,000 PA jobs. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, hindsight is like, I could have started that fucking 6 weeks later and would still be grinding my whole life away. And I could have at least right after college driven across the country with a buddy and seen the world. I hadn't even been to California at that point. I could have done a lot of cool shit. Mm-hmm. But no. And also because society plus my parents plus college plus the internship told me like the best thing that can possibly happen to you is to get a job that starts right after college.
Mm-hmm.
Even if it was a 12-week permalance job, you know what I mean? And I tricked myself into doing this thing that, and I mean, I'm proud of myself and I'm very happy. I'm always happy to say I was a PA because so many of my contemporaries in the entertainment or comedy business are like, no, I kind of like, you know, just lived in my dad's apartment in the West Village while I was auditioning until I got my first commercial, you know, like, no, my parents sent me to NYU where I was able to like take UCB classes and also a $60,000 a year education while I did blah. Like so many of my, and I'm like, oh, well, I was working 60 hours a week and writing my Spanx at night with a friend who was a waiter and we can only work two, you know what I mean? Like, Mm-hmm. I did all that. So I'm proud to have that.
Yeah.
I don't fault anyone else because, like, if my parents were like, why don't you just get an internship in LA and we'll rent you a studio in Venice? Like, I would not have said no. I wouldn't have been like, no, I need to learn hardship. So I don't fault any of my friends, but I do wear my badge of, like, struggling with being a PA and intern and all that shit for, you know, several years after college. Like, I wear all that proudly.
Yeah, and it's something... It's so important to kind of emphasize right now with just everything shut down and a lot of people coming out of college. It's like, oh, there are zero jobs. There's not even if I had the best, you know, ins or whatever, there's just like nothing going on right now.
Yeah.
Just being like, it's okay for this period of time. It's horrible and it's not ideal. And it's everything that's happening today is the worst. It's so depressing to think about.
Yep.
But as far as like the timeline of your life, it's okay to take this year and survive. You know, it doesn't all have to be building your career.
Yeah, and focus on health, family.
Exactly.
Yeah, I know. And like I was able to mentally handle that until entertainment started slightly opening up and I randomly see my friends working and then FOMO kicks in. It was way easier to be cool with not working when no one was working.
When no one was, exactly.
But now now I'm being reminded like, hey, even before the pandemic, I wasn't working all the time. Because that's all, like talking to all my friends who were like, you know, work in assorted areas outside of entertainment. They're like, yeah, when this shit's all over, blah, blah. I'm like, yeah, you know, when this shit's all over, it wasn't like I was working steady before this shit hit. Like as soon as the world opens back up, I'll be excited to, you know, get back to acting. It's like, if they'll have me, of course.
Exactly.
Of course, that's completely up to them.
But I want to talk more about your PAing and intern stuff. But first, let's jump into a segment we like to call Walkie Talk.
Go for Gabrus.
So this is an experience of a listener about their production job. So he writes, one of the most taxing experiences I've had as a PA was on a feature that shot at two different airports during the length of the shoot. Both of the airports were pretty tiny, but locking down the sets was a nightmare for the exterior shoots.
Oh, yeah.
Essentially, I was posted up in the parking lot telling people to wait for us to get the shot before they could come in. Turns out that's a fantastic way for strangers to start yelling at you. Once they started yelling, then I had to ask them to quiet down because we were rolling. I guess no one wanted to miss their flight for a big Hollywood production. One time, I told a woman that we were shooting and asked her to wait until the end of the take. She told me no and ran right through the set while we were shooting. A lot of people tried to sneak around the PAs, and it was just a blast. At one point, people started to figure out who was in the movie and started taking pictures of the two stars.
Uh-oh.
I will never forget the amount of people who blamed me specifically for missing their flights. So, lockdown duty is like the most anxiety-inducing thing on a PA set, like on a PA job.
100%. I say up there with the PA who's in charge of like keeping tabs on talent.
Yeah. Yeah,
because they don't care. The talent is not like
they're smoking on the roof.
Yeah, exactly. And they're like, they need you now. And they turn to you turn to the PA and go, they don't need me right now, bro. And they're like, wait, what? Yes, they do. And you're like, nah. Like, no, I can't tell them I'll be down in 10 minutes. It's like they're telling me to tell you to come now. It's like, tell them I'll be down in 10 minutes. Like, oh no.
Yeah. It's such a hard middleman job, and it's because both people have such power and you have none, and it's just, and then when you throw in, you know, if you're locking down a set like on the street, you have these people that don't really have any power, but then also can just like create like a scene, and you're like, I don't want this to be a big deal. It's just a no-win situation.
Yeah, lockup duty is not fun. I mean, fire watch is not fun, but it's like you feel better. Like it's like lower stakes, but like, You know Christian Bale is going to fucking curse you out if you let this person fucking wander into the site.
Exactly.
And that's so scary. I was so frequently an office PA. That was like pretty much what the PA job was a lot of transcribing and like a lot of office shit, minimal like set stuff, minor set stuff. But the scarier thing than even lockup for me, because I started in New York as a PA, is driving. Driving is the scariest part of the business, I think.
I can't even imagine in New York, like a box truck in New York.
A New York 15 past on like fucking, and you're fucking, also if you live in New York, especially if you're a PA, you don't have the money for a fucking car. You haven't, I hadn't driven a car since like, you know, I drove it a little bit in high school and college.
Yeah.
And I did not fucking touch it. And then all of a sudden I'm like, oh shit. I like, you know, it's like, oh, do you want to drive this 15 pass? We got to go to the set. I'm like, honestly, like, this is going to make you want to fire me, but I think someone besides me should do this. And they're like, what? Yeah. No. And I'm like, sorry, dude, I can't. I'm too scared.
Yeah. So I worked on like a fair amount of like carpool karaoke's for the Late Late Show, like when I was first starting out.
And oh yeah, one of my good buddies and birthday buddy is like the head writer.
Oh no! Oh wait, Ian?
No, Dave.
Or no, Dave.
Oh, Ian Carmella's bud. Yeah, Dave Young is the head writer of Carpool Karaoke. Oh, were you doing it for Late Late Show?
I was doing it for a Late Late Show, but yeah, we actually, when Talking Dead was in the office, our offices were right next door to the Apple TV Carpool Karaoke. So that's your friend.
Did you work on Talking Dead?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, so here's a weird, interesting side story. Uh-huh. I am in the unaired pilot for the Talking
Dead. No way.
Yes, me and Scott Ian from Anthrax were the two guests for Chris Hardwick's test shoot, because I did a lot of work with Embassy Row back in the day. And I was kind of friends with them. I had done some like PA/low-level talent shit. And they were like, well, you know, Gabrus is funny enough. Just let him guess on this. He like knows zombies and stuff. Uh-huh. And so that was my origin story. And then they never had me on the regular one, which is fine. I'm not famous enough for that. Eventually I would be on At Midnight and Hardwick would mention, he'd be like, actually, Gabrus was on the unaired, and he said it on an episode of At Midnight to me. And I was like, this is pretty fucking cool that he mentions that.
Yeah, that's cool. Yeah, it's so funny. I was looking at, because you did, what was the show? Substitutes? Is that what it's called?
Yeah, that was with Embassy Row, the Substitute.
Yeah, with Embassy Row. Yeah. And then I was looking at like the list, and Jen Patton, I don't know if you know Jen, but I was her assistant.
Wait, is that pop? Do you know, Jen and I, we moved to LA at the same time right after the Substitute. We were really tight. I was tight with, one of my best friends is still David Tui, who worked at Embassy Row for a long time.
That's so crazy. Yeah, yeah. I was Jen's assistant for, I wasn't actually her assistant for that long. I started in like March of like 2017, maybe 2018. Such a small world.
Yeah, I was hanging out with Jen like a lot because we just all moved out here together. Yeah, I haven't spoken to her in a long time, but I am going to email her after this record. But I first met Michael Davies and Jen Kelly when I was a contestant on a game/reality show they Embassy Row produced in like 2004, which I begged my PA, my segment producer, I begged them to let me get a week off from my job to go go live at this apartment in Midtown and be on a like game show. how fucking weird is that?
That's awesome. Yeah, it's so funny the things that like. At that point, you don't know what your thing's gonna be, where you're headed, and so you're just like throwing stuff against the wall, and you're like weighing your options of like two things that are like kind of like PA-ing's like okay, like I guess, and then like being on a reality show's like exciting, but then also like, am I gonna be a reality like following that to like it's. Furthest conclusion or whatever is like, do I want to be like a reality?
At the time, I spent like every day at my job. Going on Craigslist and like looking up like, you know, and I, cause I just did not know what to do. So I was looking up like shit on Craigslist, like, writing, you know, like writing jobs, acting jobs. And like the sketchiest shit was on Craigslist and Mandy.com was like a entertainment, like a thing for a while. Mm-hmm. I was trying anything to get like, you know, into the business and I didn't even know what I was like really doing.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I will say for like, if this makes anyone feel any better, for like the 5 years after I was a PA at VH1, arguably 10 years, a lot of the jobs I got were connections I started at Best Week Ever or VH as a PA.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like,
yeah,
my first TV writing job was from a dude who was a writer on Best Week Ever, who got offered the head writer position, had a low-level writer position open, and did the thing. I got to shout out Chris DeLuca here. Did the thing where he said, hey, I know you don't, might not want to like leave VH1, but I can get you this job. It's a writing credit. I'll be the head writer. It's about video games. So that's why I know you know video games and I think you're funny. And no one had said that to me yet. I had gotten that a couple of times like in like my improv classes of like, oh, you're good at this, but this was someone, and I had taken meetings with the head, the writing supervisor, the EPs, the head producers, everyone that worked on Best Week Ever to ask them about advice on how to become a writer. And I won't use the woman's name because I don't want to disparage her, because I made some enemies at that. I made some enemies and I learned some things about shit I don't want to do and when I'm in charge. And I met with a woman who was like in charge of hiring the writers, and I wrote a simulated packet, and she's like, this is really good. What makes you want to be a writer on the show? I was like, well, I'm funny. I like working on this show, and I think it would be I would have more fun if I was a bigger part of the show and got to do more. And then she said to me, that's the wrong answer.
Gosh.
And I was like, oh, okay. And she's like, yeah. And then like wrote me off and never like followed up with me. We never talked about, and I was just like, oh, okay. Yeah. Fuck this. This isn't what this is like. This isn't what I thought it was at all. We're all in a fucking weird ass situation now. Yeah. Fuck. And I got so pissed, and then I got the vibe that they were never going to let me be anything. I got passed over for like the AP promotion a couple of times, which is like the path in those worlds is like PA, AP,
and that's
segment
just like
producer.
Such a huge jump. Like, it's that's like the hardest, like, to get people to think of you as a producer rather than a production assistant is like the hardest thing.
Right. And it's crazy because the way these systems are designed at these places is like the shit rolls downhill. So like every raise you get is like a bunch more money and way less work. Like it's insane that it works out like this. Eventually, like in the Viacom thing, you're a producer, which means you have to like watch edits. I mean, now I know there's way more that's involved, but like the system is like, I'm making $100 a day. I'm working 10 a.m. to 11 p.m. This producer is making $500 a day and is working way less and telling me to do all this shit along the way.
Yeah.
And it's just like, oh, this is fucking disheartening.
And I want to know more about that switch. But first, I want to let our listeners know, if you have any onset stories you'd like to share, feel free to email us at panationpodcast@gmail.com or find us on Twitter and Instagram at PA Nation Podcast. Let's take a break. And we're back. So I love the idea of talking a little bit more about the shift from, so did you ever make it to the AP position and stuff like that? Or was your path a little bit more on the creative writing side?
I jumped over to creative for a while. I should probably break this down a little bit. One of the dudes, another person I need to give a shout out to, part of my like origin story, these two, Chris DeLuca, the guy who gave me my first writing gig on, and eventually would get me way more jobs. And then eventually I would also get him jobs. I hired him to write on The Substitute,
nice.
Which was, so I got to pay it forward to that. Chris DeLuca and Kevin Marr, who is another like writer, producer in the Viacom world, who's like a big movie buff, older dude. Not old. In hindsight, right now he's probably 44. But when I was 22, I was like, this man is like, you know, like this man is taking me. He has a kid and he's talking to me about my future. Because I was like, he was doing a lot of very fun, interesting stuff, and he had worked at a bunch of different places, and he had a good head on his shoulder and lived in my neighborhood and was very kind. And one of the few people that would like take time to like look over to me and be like, well, yeah, you know, like a lot of writers have to have this sample, or like, yeah, you got to kind of, and like explained a lot of small things to me over the years that other people weren't doing over the couple of years I worked there. So when I decided, when I talked to him about after having that meeting where that woman said that shit to me and like nothing was going my way, I said to him, I was like, can we go out for like, I'll treat you to lunch and can we just talk about it? And he's like, I'll treat to lunch. And yes, we can go talk. So we went out to lunch I said, like, I don't know what to do. I feel like I'm stuck as a PA. There's so much stuff I want to do. I don't think they'll give me a chance here. And he was like, they won't. They see you as a PA. You'll only ever be a PA here. Mm-hmm. And that's fine. He's like, you have to leave. And I go, leave? He goes, how much money do you make a week? And I like they know. Everyone knows the rates that mm-hmm. works on the show. And he's like, I tell him, he's like, yeah. So did you know that New York State unemployment is $400 a week, a.k.a. more than you're making right now? And I was like, huh? He's like, yeah, you know, and you earned it. Like, and you're a freelancer. So if you don't get hired again, you're technically able to collect unemployment. And if you're able to collect unemployment, you can not work for 6 months and make the same amount of money you're making now. But in those 6 months, you can make connections, you know, write stuff, do comedy, take meetings, go on auditions, scour Craigslist, Mandy, take up random jobs, and I was like, holy shit. And he's like, the big advice he gave me is like, the only thing you have to do is do something in your time off so that when it ends, you don't look back on your time and go, shit, I did nothing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I was like, oh, yeah. And he's like, even if that means watch all of The Sopranos. He's like, or, you know, like, write a book. Like, he's like, whatever you want to do, just do that. Just make sure you don't feel like you wasted your time. Mm-hmm. So I fucking quit. I got passed up for that AP promotion. I said something to... I had some beef with one of the executive producers. Like, they tried to hit me with, like, the bullshit rolls downhill. The blame mm-hmm. rolls all the way downhill to me. Mm-hmm. And tried to put some shit on my back about how production was almost late on an episode. And I was like...
That's insane.
Yeah. And I'm like, that's not how it works.
Like, am I being paid to be an EP? Because I don't think I am.
They said it to me in the middle of... the all company meeting on a Monday. They were like,
that's just, yeah.
So, and there's like 40 people in the room, and my EP creator showrunner, whose name I'll also leave out because I'll disparage him, piece of shit, took a moment to be like, and we almost didn't get it out on time, blah, 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 because Gabrus was like late to get this. And I stood up in front of everyone and said, if Best Week Ever almost didn't happen because one PA couldn't find a footage of turkey being basted that you wanted in a very specific way, then there is a flaw in how the show is produced.
I love that.
And I was passed over for promotion, and I had a meeting with another producer who I loved. I'll give Sean Johnson a shout out, who was like, "This." You can easily figure out who all these people that sucked were, by the way, with a little light going. But Sean Johnson, who fucking ruled, took
Sean
me in.
Sean Johnson, the Olympic gymnastics.
Yes, yes. Who we did call Sean John. and we were like, I was like, Sean John. He took me to a meeting. He's like, look, we're going to give Ellen, shout out to Ellen, she was very talented, the AP position. I don't want you to think of this as blah, 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 but I understand. And I'm like, no, I feel like this is going to continue to happen for me. If you don't mm-hmm. think I'm AP material, then what the fuck? Like, if you don't think I'm good enough to like switch from transcribing footage to clearing music tracks
and also transcribing footage,
yeah. And it's like, if you can't give me an extra $20 a day to stay alive here, well then and I'm like, they're like, so I understand if you want to leave. I'm like, well, if you're not going to promote me, I guess you can let me go. And being let go from a freelance job means you can collect unemployment. So I just walked out of there and I was like, holy shit. I remember my parents being like, what the fuck are you doing? And I was like, I'm realizing, and like, this is disheartening. I'm like, I'm going to work 75 less hours a week and make the same amount. Like, you can't actually earn more because it's like all like...
Yeah, it's all the percentages of whatever.
I think I was taking home eventually when I was getting... I was paid the highest PA rate at the time, which was $130 a day, which you had to get like special permission from like Viacom accounting to give someone $750 a week to work 70, 80 hours. So I was making that. And then... after taxes, that was like 412 or 440 or 460, something like that. Mm-hmm. And when I switched to unemployment, it was 344.
Yeah.
So all I had to do was find $50 cash a week gigs or like spend 50 less dollars, mm-hmm. which you switch to you don't need an unlimited Metro card anymore. You know, you like figure out ways. I eat rice and beans from Bonita on Bedford Avenue like every night for a long ass time. But I was just so pumped to not work and live like this weird, what I thought was an artist life.
Yeah, yeah.
But then I would eventually have to come slamming back to getting like temping jobs, bartending jobs, mascot jobs, like every PA, AP, writer's PA, writing job, segment producer, random. And I just worked. That's why I think my, when you even said it earlier, my resume is like all over the place.
Yeah.
I have been working unbroken and without ever like, major success. Like, I've had enough success that on paper I'm like considered an actor, comedian, podcaster or whatever, but I never had major enough success that I could ever slow a hustle down.
Yeah.
So my resume and the amount of people I've worked with over the years is just so insane. And it's not even like it's a good resume of like, holy shit, this guy's unstoppable. It's like, wait, you did what for like 3 years? I'm like, yeah, dude, I did prank phone calls for radio stations where I pretended to be a dude getting cheated on for $50 a call. Mm-hmm. And they were sometimes on LA time, so I'm doing them at 3 in the, you know, like weird ass hours and shit. But yeah, anything to fucking stay. And I just did that for the last 50. I'm still technically doing it. I'm weirdly an influencer or a podcaster. I'm, you know, I do like as much shit as I can for as, I have like 40 different $100 revenue streams.
Mm-hmm. Which adds like, up. It really adds up. And it's what it's what you need to do to, you know, do what you want to do to have right, that agency.
And if we want to just go like absolutely full circle at, to back what we were talking about in the beginning, therein is a good time. What I'm describing is perfect, like setup for someone whose abilities are all over the place and curious and comfortable with change.
Yeah.
Like, thank fucking God I have all that, because I later on in life would just go on to do thousands of different bullshit jobs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's so true. It's like I grew up homeschooled, and so our schedules were all over the place. And I feel like that weirdly like prepared me for this thing, because it is like, okay, I have to wake up at 3 a.m. and I have to work 12 hours and then I go to sleep and then I have to, you know, meet a friend for like some, we're writing something or, you know, whatever it is. And it's like managing that kind of schedule, like pulling from your entire experience of your whole life, like everything informs everything else as far as I can tell.
100%.
I love that you had, in the midst of all of these kind of like disparate things that you were doing, you had the improv and like UCB system at the time to kind of act as an anchor, it seems like.
Yeah, an anchor, and to make me feel better about how shitty my fucking PA job was and how no one there is giving me the time of day of like, you know, like, oh, you do comedy, cool. But like, I'm fucking transcribing Paul Scheer, who's my level 2 teacher at the time. Like, I'm transcribing his clips and I'm like, I'm this close. Like, I'm in the world of, I'm like living in this world where there is, you know, people I know work in entertainment. I'm meeting people who do shit. I'm like this. And there's just like this kind of stuff where I'm like, oh, you know, you find these moments and you're like, oh, this is like, why I do everything I do. Like, I made someone laugh in an interview, I came up with a funny idea, or like they might not be thinking I'm funny at all at Best Week Ever, but here I am making my teachers laugh, making my classmates laugh, getting drinks with people after the fact, and also people who knew what Best Week Ever was and thought it was cool that I worked there. You know what I mean? That wasn't something else that was happening too frequently. Like, no one seemed to care about that shit.
Yeah. And while you were working, was that group of like PAs and stuff like that, were they kind of on the same path as you? I know like John Mulaney and like Nick Kroll were like, they were kind of like assistants to like, I think they were assistant to Jesse Klein maybe or something like that. Like in that world of like, VCOM
a lot of the people I worked with would eventually, like Brian Foss, who's like a writer, a producer, and he was a UCB comedian. We shared a lot of people, like John Murray of Stucky and Murray, like these comedy group. A lot of people were doing, and that was the other. That was what made the PA job tolerable, is that it was sort of like my grad school. I'm around like all these people who are like, I went to Columbia Film School and now I'm making $100 a day doing this. Or like, I have like three short films that I've shot on like fucking and edited on like Avid, but today I'm doing this job. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah, totally.
So there was a lot of people like that, and that was kind of inspiring. A lot of people, not a lot of people trying to straight up be talent. I mean, I bet you if we go back through, you know, that this was 04 through like 06. If we go back, I look up everyone. I'm sure a few of them tried to host something or do some shit over the day because everyone was like too talented to be there, really. Do you know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
and that's kind of like with a lot of PA jobs is like, you know, so many legendary directors and producers and talent have been PAs because it's like, that's how I work and that's how you get work in the business.
Yeah.
So then it's funny to imagine like being in this world where like you're like, oh, fucking Brian De Palma, the next Brian De Palma is a PA on, you know, on this show, which not a lot of people network laterally to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
They only network like upwards.
Yeah.
But forget that, network downwards.
Yeah.
Like, I've now been in this business long enough that people that were my students at UCB or people that were PAs on things I've shot are now asking me to do a day on something that they're working like. They've all surpassed me, like, and I'm not complaining. Like, I'm happy where I am. So every time I work with, I'm like, if I'm still in this business in 10 years, this person right now who's taking my coffee order could arguably be hiring me to get a SAG day rate down the road.
Yeah.
So I might as well be fucking cool.
Yeah, it's true. It's so true. And it's something that it's such a test of patience because like, I have no problem being like friendly and hanging out with people. Like, it's not like I hate doing that kind of thing.
Right.
But if you are in that situation, like if you are the kind of person where you're like socializing just isn't your thing or you feel uncomfortable like doing that kind of thing, it's so worth it if just for like, it's like investing in stocks or something like that, you know, like
yes.
Diversify your portfolio, like have your what is it, eggs in multiple baskets or whatever, and just like see what happens. And I mean, for me, it's like, you know, I'm not like best friends with everyone I've ever PA'd with, but like I'm cool with everyone, and it's fun to see what like people end up doing, you know.
Honestly, like talent is like being good at your job is the number one thing that will get you hired again, but right behind it, like saying it's number one with 100 points at number two with 99 points is being cool to work with.
Yeah.
And if people like to work with you, you can work forever. You can actually, if people like to work with you and you're not good at your job, you can survive longer than if you are good at your job and people don't like you.
Yeah, totally.
Like, which is crazy. Especially at that level, because especially in the business we're talking about, because it is so collaborative and so like, if you're working on a film set, like, or you're working on whatever show you get hired on, it's 12 to 16 hours a day for 5 days with like weird hours, nonstop time. You eat lunch together, you drive together, what, you know, what all the shit you have to do. That's all you're asking for a lot when you hire someone to work on your production. So if you're remotely cool to be around, not even like people don't even have to like you. You just have to be okay to be around. Do you know what I mean? Like, and which is a low bar, but people blow it.
Mm-hmm.
Don't get me wrong. People fuck that up frequently.
Yeah. It's so funny that I've been like really trying to like figure out what is going on with all of the, I mean, in particular, what's going on with like Ellen and, you know, all of that kind of stuff where it's like these like high ranking EPs or whatever are the ones that are tough to be around. And I'm wondering if it's because like everyone else has to act so cool around people that the people at the top feel like they can act however they want. I don't know. I'm trying to figure that out. And
well, there's a lot of like, there's a lot of in Hollywood and entertainment and actually a lot of jobs, but I can only speak with my example from entertainment.
Mm-hmm.
People who make it that long and get to the top like that, they like definitely ate a lot of shit along the way.
Yeah.
And then they're here to fucking let it rip.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, like there's not even doesn't even land on them that the culture has changed at all.
Mm-hmm.
All they see is like, when I was a PA, it sucked.
Yeah.
So I don't give a fuck if it sucks for you guys.
Yeah.
And that's sort of like, I see this generationally, and like this is so anecdotal, so forgive me for becoming fucking soapbox Johnny here for a second, but you see that with like racism and hard work and bootstraps. It's all like this whole thing of like, the example I always give is like, my dad would hit me and my brothers, not like beat our asses, but we got physical punishment. Not a lot of my friends did. And none of my friends who have kids now, I couldn't even imagine them yelling at a kid mm-hmm. for spilling ice cream or for not doing something dangerous or dumb. Like, mm-hmm. but I used to get like hit for doing that. But my dad was like, well, my father used to really beat my ass. Mm-hmm. So you're lucky. And it's like,
yeah,
but also you could just stop this. Like,
yeah.
And then I'm not going to hit my kids at all. I'm not probably not even going to have kids, not because I was hit, but like for another plenty of other reasons, because I chose to work in entertainment, really. Uh-huh. But like, there's a part of me that's like this, like, it's up to you, just because. And people are like, I was bullied. And it's like, OK, people were racist against me when I was, you know, my people when I was young. It's like we're allowed to stop this. We don't owe it to society to like shit it back into their mouths. Mm-hmm. Like we could just nip it in the bud. So I think a lot of these people who like survived like the rough, like the way Hollywood used to be of like, well, you used to be able to talk like this and act like this. And it's like we used to be fucked up on set all day. And it's like, I think we're learning that that was bad. Yeah. Like, relax. Like, but and that's, and then also, as we talked about, bullshit rolls downhill. If a PA says a producer is like, up until probably a couple of years ago, if a PA spoke up about a producer, the PA would just be let go on the next cycle or mm-hmm. be told like, oh, yeah, we'll deal with that. And nothing would happen.
Yeah.
So like, PAs just stop speaking up. Like, it's like, fuck it. I can't afford to lose this job.
Yeah.
And that's where shit gets really sketchy, is where it's like, I can't afford to lose this job, so talk to me and treat me however you want. And that's like the bummer about this entire business. Like, of all the low-level jobs of like, and I'm not even go below, like, and I mean below in pay and treatment and not in like status, because like migrant workers are doing way more important shit than the guy who's making sure the talent's fucking folding chairs are set up in order.
Mm-hmm.
But like, shit rolls just downhill to those people where it's like, just shut, you know, like, I can only imagine that's why the fucking EPs at Ellen feel like they're bulletproof and can do whatever they want.
Yeah, yeah, I totally agree. A lot of these things that we're talking about, I feel like, circle around the idea of like perception and how people perceive other people. And it's interesting with your story, how you've kind of shape-shifted a little bit from these, you know, these PA, writer, you know, segment producer, associate producer, to talent and stuff like that. Like, what was your first like taste of that? Like, oh, I think I could be like talent now. And how did you view like the producers and the PAs and stuff like that? Like, do you remember like one of your first outings on that side of the camera?
Yeah, you know, I never, like, it was such a slow climbing grind that like I never had that big moment of like, now I'm major talent, you know what I mean? I was always like, I'm more like, it started off like, oh, I'm a writer on the Spike TV Video Game Awards, and mm-hmm. now they're like, oh, we just need somebody for this, we need somebody for the table read to read all the jokes. Why don't you do it, Gabrus, because you're funny and people like you? And it's like, oh, yeah, yeah, I could do that in this meeting, and I'll do that in the and then it's like, oh, later on we're casting a sketch, and it's like, we need someone to come out and like do this like lame bit with Sam Jackson, and like I'm pitching it, and someone goes like, oh, you should just do it. And I'm like, really? And I'm like, I don't know. And they're like, well, you know, you would get like an after a day rate, because this is like a real production, so you get like $600 if you do it. And I'm like, I'm in. Like, you know what I mean? Like, I get paid for 5 days of work in one day. Yeah, I'll fucking do it. So like, that was like, that was that first thing. And I would eventually get a few more things like that over the years, and slowly build up to doing that more and more, and less having to be a PA and shit. But I always prided myself on, I know what it was like to be the shittiest person in this job. So mm-hmm. I'm not going to be rude to anyone that isn't rude. And I'm going to be as friendly as I can without affecting what I need to get done for the day.
Yeah.
When I first started showing up on sets, I would always be very cautious to come across as cool. But I also am not a phony person. So I also had to get comfortable with saying to like a PA or someone, or, you know, someone's, hey, can I just have 20 minutes alone right now?
Mm-hmm.
And like, honestly, can you come back in 5 minutes and ask me that? I just need to get this one thing. You know, like I got to the level where I was like, oh, you can like care about what you like. Once you have it in your head of like, this job will be better if I do blank. You know mm-hmm. what I mean? Like,
yeah.
And so like once I, that's like about as mean as I ever get. And it's only mean if you're truly soft and we're like, I wanted the host of this dumb game show to really like me.
Uh-huh.
But it's really helped me. And then in the few jobs I've had where I'm directly working with talent, whether it's like a host producer or a writer or punch up guy or earwig guy for these shows,
mm-hmm.
like whenever I do that, I have a understanding of what it's like to be the talent too.
Yeah.
Of like, hey, let me know if you need me to come back. Are you trying to get in your headspace or whatever? Because like, not a lot of people understand. So it's given me a good both sides of the ball. I haven't PA'd and I haven't done like real hard work in forever. So like, forgive me, but I will always be like, what's your name? I'm not going to pride myself on trying to remember it, but I'll pride myself on introducing myself and meeting people. And one of the best moments in my entertainment career was I was hosting this awful show for True TV called Hair Jacked, which was like cash cab in a hair salon. I played like I come out and sweep hair up and then reveal that you're actually on a game show. And if you failed, if you lost, you'd get a weird haircut. If you won, you'd get cash prizes. But there was like this room where I'd be watching on hidden cameras, and I was not in wardrobe yet, just hanging out in the room because the director placed me there for eyeball. And the way I dress is shorts, sneakers, and ratty t-shirts and a baseball cap, mm-hmm. aka the grip uniform. You know what I mean? Like I'm in army cargo shorts, sneakers, a ratty t-shirt, and a fucking backwards hat and I look like a fucking lighting PA or whatever.
Uh-huh.
And one of the camera guys comes in and goes, hey, who told you to sit down? And I was like, the director did. And they're like, the director told you to sit down? And I'm like, yeah. They're like, well, what are you supposed to be doing? I'm like, and I could tell that this guy doesn't realize I'm the host of the show. And I go, oh, what's your name? And he tells me his name. I go, well, I'm supposed to be here because I'm hosting the TV show you're shooting. So I know he's made a mistake and I'm not offended at all. So I'm just leaning into the bit part. And I'm mm-hmm. like, so why don't you just point your fucking camera at me and keep your mouth shut? And he's like, what? And I start hysterical laughing. I'm like, no, I'm not like that. But just, I am the host of this show. So get your fucking shit together. Hey, so.
Yeah. That's something speaking of Emma, we were talking about Emma Erdbrink before we started recording.
Shout out Emma.
Emma, wonderful, is on the podcast. She's just the best.
She's my producer for High and Mighty, and
yes.
She crushes it.
Yeah, she's great. We were talking about how you have just like such a, because she has such like a defined sense of like her worth and like her space and like what she is willing to do, what she's not willing to do, and all of that kind of stuff. And she was saying that you are very similar, and I've experienced that. I've gone to your shows. Is it Gabrus and Friends or?
Yes.
Yeah, I've been to that show, and like if anyone's talking in the audience or whatever, you shut them down, like all of that kind of stuff. It's like all very like within the bounds of your personal worth and what you believe about yourself, and I really like appreciate that, and that's something to aspire to. I feel like for anyone working in this industry is just being like, what are the things that I am cool with doing? What are the things that I feel like these people are taking advantage of me, and like being very stringent on like what those lines are.
Thank you. That was I appreciate that. Yeah, that's always just something. That's always just something. I also have some uncanny ability, if I could toot my own horn, that people don't always hate me, even if I'm saying something mean to them.
Mm-hmm.
For some reason, there's something about my face that I haven't figured out yet. I have theories that my face is like very much like a Muppet face, and that it's very big, very animated, and furry, and then also sits on top of like a giant 6'2" fucking Snuffleupagus kind of body. So I think my face. Because I refer to it as talk to me face. Like if I'm standing somewhere, somebody starts a conversation.
Uh-huh.
You know what I mean? Like
whenever
you're like, oh God, this person's coming over to us. Like if I'm standing with you, dude, you know you're safe because this person's coming to talk to me. Like they just insist. So I'm like, that's like my entire life. But also I'm able to kind of bust balls in a way that people seem to appreciate it.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't fully understand what that, I mean, And it is because I'm doing it with no harm intended. And that, mm-hmm. like, that is why, like, when I'm busting balls, it's like, this is what I do with my wife, my best friends, my family. Like, this is how I communicate. So mm-hmm. it doesn't feel like I'm being mean to you. It actually feels like I'm including you for a lot of these people are just happy to be involved on the joke.
Yeah.
So that's what's been, that's been like a skill set I've honed and gotten together. And now it's less about like the shutting down the audience members or at live shows or and stuff like that. Like that's partially about what I believe my self-worth is, but it's also partially about I have this like belief that like just fucking know how to live. just learn how to be part of society. Like you paid to come to a comedy show. Shut the fuck up.
Yeah.
And I don't need for my ego for the crowd to be absolutely full. Mm-hmm. So if I'm saying shut the fuck up and you're like, no, I want to talk, I don't need you in the audience. Like that's like you're not the type of person I want in the audience. A buddy of mine came to a show one time, was wasted, started like talking to me on stage, and I fucking destroyed him. And he's a good friend of mine. I destroyed him in front of everyone he was with, in front of the entire crowd. And he still brings it up. Like this was like 5 years ago. We're still buddies. He's editing my reel as we speak. Whenever we get on the phone, he's like, well, I learned my lesson about talking at a show. And I'm like, good. Then I help the world. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So if I teach one person that, hey, when you're a paying customer to see a piece of art, why don't you shut the fuck up and not participate and just watch? Or guess what? You can also do not go at all.
Yeah.
Your choice. Like, play the fucking game. Don't go to the movie theater, or go to the movie theater and put your fucking phone away and watch the movie.
Yes.
Want to have your phone out? Wait 2 months and you can watch it at your house with all your fucking phones out.
For some reason, I'm like the opposite of like people don't seem to talk to me. But then if I am like, if I tell someone to, if they're in a movie theater or whatever, like, turn your phone off or whatever, they get very upset with me. And so like I've gotten in so many like altercations in movie theaters, this is probably bad to say, but I need to learn your ways.
Well, there is an element too, because like when I was younger, I did have like people wanted to start fights with me all the time.
Mm-hmm.
I got over, I mean, partially because I ran with like, you know, scuzzy dudes. It happens, you know, way less fisticuffs in like the comedy world.
Uh-huh.
But like, but also often if people want to start a fight, they're going to look at who the biggest, loudest person is and everyone's laughing at me. Mm-hmm. And I'm wearing a Hawaiian shirt and I have a fucking, you know, and I'm like doing some stupid thing. And it's like, oh, I want to kick that dude's ass.
Yeah.
So that was my thing for a while. But then I got to the point where I'm like, I'm confident enough going into where like, I'm either going to not get my ass kicked because of my own physical prowess,
mm-hmm.
or most likely this guy will never kick my ass because I will make them laugh. Or
yeah. You diffuse things very well.
Yeah, I've always been like that. And so like I have that in my back pocket whenever I walk into these situations.
Yeah,
so
I need to learn that.
Yeah. And I think part of it is I haven't had to do it as an adult, but as like a, I mean, I guess in your 20s as an adult, but like I haven't had to do it as like a late 30s man. But also if you carry yourself or look like, yeah, this dude actually wouldn't sweat the action if you came for me. Like, that's the, I'm not trying to brag, but I will just make sure I look like, if you do come for me, I'm going to deliver a two-piece. Like, I'm going to, like, get something. I'm going to land something on the fucking, I'm going to get some words on the board.
Uh-huh.
So be careful.
Yeah. I knew these are all great tips.
I guess you're about my height. Put on 100 pounds. And then you can.
I think there should just be, like, a Gabrus teaches you how to fight, like a self-defense class. That you can
Gabrus
do,
teaches you how to look like you can fight so that you never actually have to fight. But God help you if you do, just be able to do this move.
So just wrapping up now, I feel like we could do a part two of this. I love hearing your stories, but looking back.
Talking is my thing, so thanks. I was like, here, go for it, bro.
Yeah. What are some things that, you know, at the beginning of your career, you wish you had known that you kind of lean on more now? Do you have anything that you're like, oh, man, this is something that, like, that would have been super helpful?
Yeah, I feel like if someone sat me down early on in the business and explained to me that, like, Because it took me until, and I'm not exaggerating, like in the last couple of years with therapy and like really introspective thinking and stuff to like realign what I consider success.
Mm-hmm.
And like now getting to do what I love. I'm 38 and I don't have a backyard or a dishwasher or like most expensive thing I own is the microphone and computer I'm talking to you through. Like I don't have like anything cool in life like that. But my success is the fact that I've gotten to do this for the longest time. And I did not ever think I could only look at the people who are more successful next to me and be like, I want to be on four seasons of a TV show. Mm-hmm. I want to be shooting a movie that shoots overseas. And now I'm like, in the last few years, I've been getting to do comedy full time without having to ever temp or teach improv or bartend again. Mm-hmm. And I love bartending and I loved teaching improv, but I don't want to do it anymore. And the fact that I don't anymore is a success.
Mm-hmm.
And I just need this ability. And this is another thing I wish someone taught me when I was younger, is like zoom out. Cause you were kind of saying it earlier, how, being homeschooled prepped you for being a PA. Like being a freelancer has prepped me for the pandemic in a way that this isn't the first time I've gone 6 months without work. like I've done this multiple times before. And all you hope is that the times get shorter and shorter, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like,
yeah. Exactly.
So eventually it's like, oh, but once you're able to go, like, for example, like every year around Thanksgiving, you know, things start to slow down and then there's less shoots in November and December and then things don't pick up again until like late January, mid February, and you're like, oh fuck, I haven't worked in like 2 months, I'm stressed, I have no money, the holidays, this, that, and then all of a sudden you bounce, like the day goes on and you're like, oh, I got a job, it's mid February, oh, I'm working in March, oh shit, yeah, I'm not, money never really fell apart, and it's like, oh wait, this has happened 4 years in a row now. I have to start just knowing that this happens.
Yeah.
And like, and now when like a month comes, I have the ability, when like I don't work for an August randomly, and I'm like, well, that's, you know, us freelancers and entertainment especially, you attach so much self-worth to working and like everything you do is designed around this work. But when you zoom out and go, hey, it's just 1 month off, really. I got a lot of work this other time, but when you're in it, it's so hard to see that it's not only does it end eventually, but it is brief and this, that, the other thing. But instead, you just let yourself spiral completely out of control, not thinking about it, thinking about it. And then you go, and now I'm at the point where I'm like, hey, I've demonstrated like 7 years in a row of like somehow pulling off each year.
Mm-hmm.
So now let's just not go down in the dumps anymore. Let's keep striving and trying hard, but I'm not going to let my brain go completely into despair when I get like a slow couple of months.
Mm-hmm.
Like I've managed in the pandemic. Part of the reason I was successful in the pandemic is, yes, I'm built to not work. I have the ability. I've done it before. I'm a stoner. I'm a gamer. I can do podcasts from my house. A lot of stuff I can feel alive doing. Of all that, because no one else is working, I don't have any FOMO. Now the FOMO is starting to kick in. Now I'm starting to feel it a little bit. Now I'm like, I want to work. I want to go back. But other than that, that would be the advice. 45 minutes after your one closing question. to answer your question succinctly, I would let someone teach me to have, I would wish I would have learned to have like court vision and year vision and be like, and that a miss and not getting this one job, you know, is like, that doesn't mean nothing else is going to happen. Like, that's the hardest thing. Like, that's the hardest thing for me.
Yeah.
And then and having learned that has made life way easier for me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I love that. Is court vision, is that a basketball thing? I'm so not a basketball person.
Yeah. It's a basketball thing. It means that, like, you're not caught up in, like, what's happening in the, like, a foot and a half in front of you. Like, you can kind of see the game from a different way, which is important.
Yeah. It's the football one, like downfield vision. Is that?
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
Is that the football one?
I'm very sporty, if you couldn't tell.
Oh, yeah, I'm getting that vibe.
Yeah.
Is that the football one? You're like a foreign neighbor.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, this has been amazing. Is there anything you would like to plug at this point in the podcast?
Oh, hell yeah. If you want, check out my podcast, High and Mighty, or I also have a Patreon podcast called Action Boys. Those are the two big things right now. Check them out if you're at all interested. But if not, don't worry about it.
And you're Gabrus on Twitter, right?
I'm at Gabrus on all social media.
There you go.
Yeah.
Simple.
Yep.
This has been so fun. Thank you so much for being on the show. As we have said, this is a big deal for us. So
for both of us.
Both of us.
This is huge for me, but
awesome. Well, that's it. Bye, everyone.
Bye.
I'd like to thank John Gabrus for taking the time to come on the show, and my producer Liz Maupin for helping me put this episode together. I'm Cooper Peltz, and this has been PA Nation. See you next time.